note from my 21-year-old self.
And what would your 21-year-old self make of you today? That's what I'll be asking the director of this Australian cult classic.
Oi! Oi, you! Hey! Hey! Dickhead! I'm talking to you! Hey, you! Prick face!
Think someone's talking to you, Sharpies?
Me?
Yeah! You! Are you from the planet Poofta? Or the planet Stupider?
Think carefully before answering, Sammy.
Hey! Didn't you hear me?
Well, he sounds positively charming. A scene there from Dogs in Space. It's 30 years ago since that film was released, and director Richard Lowenstein joins me on the Sunday sesh. Hello, Richard.
Hi. We just actually made a film about the guy who just had the opening line.
That guy himself?
Yeah, That's Troy Davies. That was the lead character in Ecce Homo, which we just finished.
Oh, wow. Tell me a little bit about that film then.
Well, Ecce Homo is it's a remarkable story of sort of child abuse, incest, and fighting against all those odds to still lead an incredibly charismatic and extraordinary life. Troy Davies was our stylist and makeup and co-director and co-conceptualer of all our music videos, and he was on Strikebound. He did makeup on Dogs in Space. He became a very close friend with Michael Hutchins and all the pop stars he worked with, Bono and all that. And he just he contracted AIDS very early on, but went on. You know, he was an incredible survivor. He went on to become Australia's longest surviving AIDS patient before he finally succumbed in 2007 or something like that. And he always used to tell these extraordinary stories with a sense of humour about being raped by his brother and his father doing this, and everyone would just think it was part of his shtick, his joke. And along the way, we started taking him seriously, started filming him over the years. And so it's an archival documentary, but it's basically about, you know, how underneath the joke there's this element of truth.
And a bit of a tribute to him, obviously.
Yeah. It's also a tribute, but also just really it's more of a look into the nature of truth and lies and exaggeration. You know, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, but then underneath there is the truth as well. What is the truth? What is truth? Things like that. But it's a insane film. It's really sort of uses all the archive from the 80s and the 90s and music, you know, behind the scenes footage of the filming of Dogs in Space, Michael and Troy interviewing each other and things like this.
It sounds fascinating. Mm. Now you were in your early 20s or late 20s when Dogs in Space came out.
I was in my mid-20s. I was born in 1959, so Dogs came out in 86, so I'd be 26, 27.
It's called a bit of a Australian cult classic now, but back then some of the critics weren't so kind, were they? How did you react to some of the criticism when you were a young man?
Oh, I loved the negative reviews. I got to say that legend has gotten bigger than the reality. There wasn't that many bad reviews, but when they were bad, they were really bad. I remember very clearly Bill Collins, as a quote, like...
The one with the glasses, I remember him on midday TV, right?
Yeah, and everything in the film just was abhorrent to him, and... You know, he called it just one of the worst Australian films ever made. Why would anyone, you know, aimless? It was a great, it was a really capsule review in the Herald Sun, and it was brilliant. I loved it. And then at the same time, we had Neil Gillett calling it the opposite, one of the best Australian films ever made. Then we had Melody Maker in England call it the best film about rock and roll ever made, you know, which was a huge buzz. So it's like, you know, but I got to say, I've been brought up in a very sort of almost communist environment by my parents, and the bad reviews entertain me more than the good ones. So, you know.
I want to get to your parents shortly, but does it surprise you that 30 years on, I was reading that people actually still make the pilgrimage to 18 Berry Street in Richmond a suburb of Melbourne, because that's where the film was made. And apparently young kids these days actually make pilgrimages there as a tribute to the film. Does that blow your mind?
Well, it certainly never expected it because, you know, I mean, there was a lot of films made in the 80s and very few of them have any resonance now. And, you know, a lot of them are laughable. And so, yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't expect it. We just wanted to make a film as... We were aware we wanted to make a film that had a timeless quality, that it was going to be as good as we could do it. And but it's very bizarre. It's even more bizarre having lived in that house. And so, you know...
We actually lived in that physical house.
I lived in there and with my cameraman, Andrew De Groot, and a number of film students and punks. There was Sam Sajafka, the guy that the Michaels character is based on. And... So that is more bizarre, having lived there and then having the house become a pilgrimage.
Like, you know? A shrine.
Yeah, like a shrine. And I sort of guess in the, you know, because but by the time we were filming and we knew Michael was in it and everything, we thought, oh, this might be something. And there was fans coming to the house and, you know, INXS had a huge following and everything. So, but, yeah, it's bizarre having lived there as in a shared house in 1979 and then finding out that, you know, buses of Japanese tourist punks come to pay homage to it, you know. It's like, and things like this. It's like, it is bizarre. But it's, you know... I like it as well. It's high. I never expected it. You know, no one remembers my first film, Strikebound, but everyone remembers the second one, which is so it's great.
There's always one that stands out, right?
Yes, yes.
And there's no rhyme or reason sometimes. It just is what it is.
We're not quite sure what we did right. You know, it's like it's a subconscious thing. I wasn't there going, we're going to make a classic film that was going to stand the test of time. We seriously thought, well, these fashions are going to look dreadful in 10 years, you know. And when you look, the weird thing is when you look at other films of that era, Pretty in Pink and the my personal favourite dreadful film of that era, Starstruck, and there's another one, Street Hero. It's just embarrassing looking at them now. It's like, oh my God, what were we thinking?
Well, you know what? I think the soundtrack probably helped. And Tight Jeans have made a comeback. They've come back full circle.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, that sort of ticks a few boxes as well. Now, you mentioned Michael a few times. Mm. Michael Hutchence, that is, who was an international star at the time. He was the lead singer of INXS. Mm. Was he cast for that particular reason?
Yes. He was. Not only was he cast, but we actually thought up, or I thought up, the idea of the film in a sort of a breakfast meeting with an Australian producer at the Cannes Film Festival in 1984. I was giving some pitch about some serious political thriller I was working on, and it was going down really badly, and Michael was at the breakfast with me because we'd been up all night partying and we'd been making music videos together and things. And so I just came up with this idea, which is from my own experience, of Dogs in Space, and the producer just suddenly became alert, you know, she'd been falling asleep, and said, that's fantastic. And I said, and Michael's going to play the lead role. And he sort of was asleep on the table and he looked up and said, am I? He said, yes, yes.
And, that's so rock and roll.
So I actually went home and wrote the script, never saw that producer again, but wrote the script with Michael in mind. And yeah, he did, I got to say, subconsciously when I was... Early on when I was his friend, I was noticing his powers of interpretation, his powers of imitation. And he actually would do some imitations of the real Sam because they knew each other and everything. And I was going, he's fantastic, you know. They're both short-sighted as well, which was fantastic.
You were very close to Michael Hutchence. I mean, you were close to INXS, but particularly to Michael. And you went on to direct some of their really well-known videos, some of my favourites, Need You Tonight, Never Tear Us Apart, Suicide Blonde. When Michael passed away, it's 19 years this year that he passed away.
Hmm.
How did that sort of affect your view of the world and your approach to your work?
Well, it sort of initially you feel numb, and my relationship with Michael was not cyclic, but it was every 6 months. You'd meet up with him every 6 months. He'd either come to Melbourne or you'd get a job with them, and then suddenly you'd find yourself in Prague, or, you know, and sort of, and then you wouldn't see each other for 6 months. So in a weird way, when it happened, it was just numbness. I didn't feel, you know, I felt the conscious, like, that's no good. But it wasn't till 6 months later, when, you know, when he was due to be in Melbourne, or the, you know, just that my body and my brain actually realised the huge loss. And, you know, I remember waking up in the middle of the night, you know, just absolutely sobbing 6 months after he died. You know, I'd even been to the funeral home, seen him dead there and everything, and I still, like, nothing. But
it was almost like your brain was expecting to catch up for your 6 monthly catch up.
Yeah, and there was a lot of years of just these, him appearing in my dreams in various states. And he was very close, but I mean, it was very tough coming. I mean, one of the reasons we made Dogs in Space was about a close friend who died of a heroin overdose. So when you're going through that period, the late 70s, early 80s, you sort of got used to incredibly close friends disappearing through all sorts of mischief. I mean, you know, the bass player of the Nick Cave's first band, the Boys Next Door, wasn't drug related, but he had a brain hemorrhage and died. I mean, you know, there's my partner's best friend, who's what we wrote Dogs in Space about, and it's just sort of.
Was it just part of that world?
It was part of the world, because what a lot of the kids were doing, what we were doing, not me, luckily, was incredibly dangerous without actually realising it. You know, it's like, oh, well, that we're told the dangers of heroin were the addiction part. We weren't told about, or we didn't know, or there was no internet. We weren't told about Hep C. We weren't told about suddenly if someone gives you too pure a dose, you can be dead like that and you're only 19, you know, as the song goes. And it's, but we certainly learnt. And what I was amazed of, we learnt, and yet people kept still doing it, the risky behaviour. And so by the time Michael's death came along, I was pretty numb to close friends dying. You know, it was incredibly sad. And as I said, the sadness is cumulative, and sometimes you just wake up, spontaneously in the middle of the night, incredibly melancholy, incredibly, you know, about the nature of life and the nature of youth and people doing. Especially in that period of youth, and that's what Dogs in Space is about, where you're feeling bulletproof, you're feeling invulnerable. You can,
but it's finite.
It's, yeah, and you can train surf. You can, you know, as they're driving around the road, you can hop on the top of the car and act like an idiot because you're in your 20s and you're going to live forever, you know, and that's, you know, the scene in the film with the VW's role. I mean, that was me. I was driving like that in a VW and in real life and
would
do incredibly stupid things. And I'm lucky to be here not so much with the drugs, but with the, you know, erratic driving. I'm a kid. Suddenly I've got my first VW. It goes like a crazy lawnmower and I'm doing incredibly stupid things in it.
Richard, other than the fact that you were all reckless, clearly, what did you and Michael bond about? He was an international rock star. You were an up-and-coming filmmaker. Was it books? Was it women? what did you have? Or was it just cars?
No, it was. There was a very clear, I've thought about this, and it was a very clear sort of things we were getting from each other. I was sort of, from the age of like 7 or 8, I was an air guitarist in front of the mirror in the bathroom. And, you know, I just secretly always wanted to be a rock star, you know. I'm not sure why, but
I can picture you as a rock star. In fact, you could be a doppelganger of Michael, I think, sometimes.
It's, in the past, that was quite deliberate. I actually based my look and my hair and the clothes. You know, I have this sort of chameleon aspect. It was, if I admire someone, I start dressing and looking like them. And it's terrible when it's a woman because I start start wearing women's clothes. No, and it's so yeah. I had this secret desire. I mean, I was incredibly shy, and I secretly wanted to play music and be a rock star. And I guess maybe some of the love and adulation that came along with that. And like, I can barely play a note, you know, but I wanted to. On the other side, Michael, growing up in a combination of the sort of Sydney's northern beaches and Hong Kong, and, you know, he wanted the credibility that Melbourne of that time, the Nick Caves, the people like me, Lynn-Marie Melbourne, the other Paul Goldman's, and the sort of cool sort of Melbourne post-punk scene, which was very not Sydney, he wanted that credibility. And I, you know, he couldn't get at Nick Cave at that stage, although I did introduce him very early on. But I represented in a complementary field that could work with his music, or In Excess's music, I represented a sort of an in to that world. And you know, we sort of, so it was like two peas in a pod, really. He was, you know, had all the adulation that I just sort of fantasized about. And there was, I remember there was one time I was standing next to Michelle Bennett's girlfriend in a nightclub, Razor it was, and he was talking to a very cute girl, and there was two other little cute, they weren't the stunning models that you saw in the stupid miniseries, but he was talking to two very cute punk girls. No, he was talking to one, and there's other two very cute punk girls behind him licking the back of his leather jacket. And I'm standing next to Michelle, who was a model and then ended up producing the film Chopper. And we're just going, what has he got? We're like, whatever he's got, we want some of it. You know?
The and, X Factor, yeah. That's why they call it the X Factor, right?
And he wasn't just the classic womanizer, you know, part misogynist sort of, you know. He didn't even really know that why he was attractive to women. It was just very non-threatening, very gentle, very sensual, and people just fell for it. It was like a safe sensuality. It wasn't the sort of like, oh, here's a guy trying to con me into bed. It was just like, you know, just slightly hippie, slightly LA, slightly London, because he had a slight English accent because of the Hong Kong upbringing. It was just intoxicating, you know.
I've got to ask, Richard, who are you trying to look like these days?
Oh, dear, I'm just trying to, whatever it is, it's 10 years ago. But I'm just trying, I don't know who I'm trying to look like. Hopefully just myself now, maybe.
You're comfortable in your own skin now.
Well, it's like, you know, as your hair gets thinner and you stay, it's like it's a whole different ball game. But, yeah, no, I think I'm comfortable in my own skin. You sort of get to a point where aging just becomes ridiculous and you can't, you know, I remember my worst being a melodramatic half-Jew, as John Safran would call me.
Of course he would.
I mean, I was more disturbed about ageing at the very first grey hair when I was 30, you know, than I am sort of now. It's just like when the grey hairs come, you just stop counting. And that's, yeah.
I got to tell you, it's horrifying. I pulled out one grey hair the other day and I automatically started thinking, oh, what colour will I have to dye my hair? And all these scared thoughts went through my brain. So,
yes.
I can understand.
But I did make a conscious decision not to fight the ageing process with all the cosmetic, you know, like Nick Cave, you see Nick Cave dyeing his hair black, yes, and then Michael tried it and everything, and I just like, nah, I'm just going to try to do this with a bit of dignity and refusing to do any dyeing or any liposuction or anything like that.
Good on you. On ABC Local Radio, this is the Sunday Sesh. I'm Sarah Plushenemish, and my guest this afternoon is filmmaker Richard Lowenstein. Now, Richard, before we get to your letter, I did want to talk about your parents. Both of your parents were activists.
Yes.
What was it like growing up in a household like that?
Well, it was it's mentioned in my letter, actually, but it's a combination of you know, the incredible frustration of being a young boy and not really understanding why these certain rules were in place. Like, why wasn't I allowed to have an air rifle, like when all my friends had an air rifle and so I could shoot birds and things like this? And, you know, the 10-year-old or the 7-year-old, whatever, you know, you can see how people can go down strange paths and lose their touch with humanity and reality and things like that. And my mother, of course, was just adamant, no television, no, you know, no air rifles, none of those things, no what she called lolly water, so no Coca-Cola. It was before the era of wholemeal bread, but there was Vogel bread. So instead of, you know, you go to the supermarket and said everyone was eating the white bread, she'd go Vogel bread and muesli and all this
stuff. Okay, so she was ahead of the curve.
She was, yeah, yeah. Though it was, you know, there still was a lot of people doing that in the 70s in Melbourne. There was places like the Feedwell Foundry and everything. So it wasn't too radical, but yeah, she was ahead of the curve, and I just wanted to eat the white bread sandwiches my friends had at school instead of this Vogel bread, you know. But, you know, it didn't take long, you know, until I was about 14 that I realised that these values were actually really quite beneficial. And you soon learn the error of your sort of, you know, testosterone poisoned ways as an early, you know, teen. So it was, without being consciously aware of the inspiration or how lucky I was, it was incredibly inspirational. I mean, my mother was an oral historian, and my father had an incredible knowledge of European history and being an escapee from Nazi Germany, and they were like two peas in a pod. He was incredibly calm and resilient, and she was as mad as a hatter and full of life and energy and motivated. The one thing on both their fronts I really am thankful for is this sense of self-motivation that they gave. It's like, if you know, it's not really about the deadline at the end of the school year or you know, having to have an institution tell you to finish your exams or whatever. It's really about how you motivate yourself when you're outside of the institution in life, when you could just sit there and watch telly all day or be on the dole like we could easily be in the early 80s, you know. You actually...
Yeah, you could, you do
know,
that.
I mean, I would end up on, you know, on beach holidays with my friends, with them all sort of... going to the beach, and I'd be there on the a bit like Safran, actually. I'd be there in the beach house banging away on an early typewriter, banging out the script to my first feature film, you know, at the age of 21, and which we unbelievably got into production by the time I was 23, you know. And it was a full period film. It wasn't some little indie thing. It was actually a 1930s period coal mining film. It was just,
which was based on one of your mum's books,
based on my
unpublished book. Yeah. But you know, yes. Clearly she was a creative like you, and clearly yes. You looked up to her.
Yes. Well, I was the tape recorder guy on all her interviews. She was an oral historian, and her first book did include Weevils in the Flower. Did include some of the stories that made their way into Strike Ban and my student film Evictions. But I was her, from the age of about 8, I was her tape recorder guy because she was terrible with technology. So I'm sort of there with the levels and the microphone, and she insisted on hand-holding the microphone, which was terrible for me because I had the headphones on going, no, stop touching the microphone, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But so I'm sitting there, you know, recording her what I call old fogies, which were her, you know, which were Australian national treasures before they died. You know, their stories of the Great Depression, and I just call them old fogies as I'm getting the levels. But obviously...
You're so kind.
I know. So, but obviously something, you know, crept into my subconscious or conscious or whatever, because that's the stories, those stories that I kept hearing. And, you know, even though I preferred Superman comics at the time, When I got to film school, it's those stories that I started putting onto film, and suddenly it all went crazy for me, you know.
Did you keep some of those tapes of the old fogies? Do you have some of them still?
Yeah, they're all in the National Library. My mother was doing, it was, you know, it was She was the Studs Terkel of Australia, and in National Library oral history terms, she's an icon. And so all her tapes went to the National Library. They're still uncatalogued, I must say, but the National Library and it's now the, I think it's not the Film and Sound Archive, but it's the National Library in Canberra. And so there's the Wendy Lowenstein collection there, mostly undigitised and uncatalogued, but they're slowly getting through them.
You mentioned you were bashing on the typewriter when you were 21.
Yeah.
So what have you bashed on the typewriter for me this afternoon?
Oh, God.
Your letter from your 21-year-old self.
Yes. I don't know. I think I've created the 21-year-old self slightly more aware of life than what he was. But you know, hey, I have bashed away. Do you want me to read it?
Take it away.
Okay, here we go. Dear old bugger, I don't know where you are or what you're doing now, but I sure hope you haven't upset that beautiful girl you just fell in love with. She is a keeper and is all heart, so don't let her get away. That's Lynn Marie.
Hi, Lynn. I know Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. I know your student film just won the Melbourne Film Festival, but listen to our mum when she says, the trouble with you, Richard, is you think your shit's worth bottling. And don't become the precocious little prick she thought you could turn into if you let all your ego stroking go to your head. Be kind and don't screw people over, and make sure to remember another of mum's maxims, united we stand, divided we fall. There is strength in numbers, and filmmaking is an art form of collaboration. So don't go around thinking you're the next Stanley Kubrick or engage in any cult of the personality bullshit, especially if that personality is you, because therein lies madness. If you're going to continue with this whole film thing, remember the industry is full of charlatans, snakes and vipers, and they are just the nice ones. So be very careful about who you get into bed with, literally as well as metaphorically. Make sure you stay true to the passion, idealism, humour, humanism and desire for experience that I set you up with. And make sure that you don't let the world grind you down into a hard, bitter and twisted cynic no matter what you have had to go through. Remember not to grow up whilst making sure you do grow up and learn from your mistakes. Don't forget films aren't everything, so keep reading. All that imagination must be good for us, I reckon. Don't stop observing and take notes of all the good stuff because your memory was never that good. Appreciate the time you have left with your funny old parents, even though Mum drives us both mad with her consistently wanting us to do things for her. They are both inspirational people who have instilled you with the best core values, and that is a rare commodity these days. If you fight with her, don't hold a grudge. Remember how Dad deals with it, with calmness, love and perseverance against all odds. So return those phone calls and make sure you go see them as often as you can. And don't put them in a bloody rest home because Mum will kill me if she finds out. Anywho, that's about it for now. I hope that big political thriller I just started writing comes off. But if it doesn't, c'est la vie. Think small, do something else, and don't get delusions of grandeur. Oh, and don't take drugs, or drink too much, or eat red meat, it makes us sick. And keep riding that bike, you need the exercise. Cheers, the 21-year-old you.
Wow, that was quite spectacular. You told yourself not to grow up.
Mm.
Do you reckon you had to in the end? Are you a bit kid at heart?
I also told myself to grow up. But, yeah, I remember really something very clear when I was interviewing Wattie Doig, who was an 80-year-old ex-coal miner, communist, for the film Strikebound, is that he still had that indefatigable spirit of a child, of an idealist. And he was 80 years old, and there was this combination of course, he was a mature man, but also a child, also the idealism. So when I say grow up, I guess the idealism about people, about life, about politics, of staying true to that child within you who believes anything is possible, you know. And at the same time, grow up because, you know, children can be incredibly myopic and narcissistic and everything. You know, it's sort of like, so it's that balance. And, you know, yeah, I've spent my life, I think, trying not to grow up as well as growing up.
And how are you doing with those snakes and vipers?
That's not pleasant. it's the film industry as against some of the other art forms. The film industry does attract some of the worst dregs of society. I think it's because of the money and fame attached with it, similar to the pop music industry. And it's always, there's always someone trying to con you. But I have met some amazing people along the way, and who are artists and really do want to make great films and don't just want to get up on the Oscars stage and create a screw you over just so they can get their budget in on exactly right. So, you know, there's all sorts of different motives in the film industry, and it's been a learning experience. And I love actually mentoring upcoming students and kids and upcoming filmmakers and sort of warning them, without being too cynical, but warning them of the dangers that lie ahead, you know.
And Richard, yeah. What happened to, I mentioned I knew Lynn. What happened to Lynn?
Well, then I probably did upset her along the way, but you know, we're still in love, and we don't live together, but we see each other every day at work, and we work together. We were together for 10 years, and then we formed a company together. Oh, we formed a company together from the very start, and we made a lot of the music videos. We're now co-directing films like Autoluminescent and Echo Homo, and I produced In Bob We Trust for her, which was her directorial effort, and we're working on other projects together. So, yes, we see each other every day, and it's like one of those friendships that you trust more than you actually can trust your own family, I guess. I mean, she is family to me, and, I've seen enough kids put their parents into rest homes to say, you know, I would trust myself in Lynn Marie's hands far more than I would trust in a family member's hands, you know.
Oh, that's heartwarming. What a great way to end, Richard. Thank you so much for joining me. That's filmmaker Richard Lowenstein. He directed the Australian cult classic Dogs in Space, which turns 30 this year. I'm Sarah Pichenelmich, and you're listening to ABC Local Radio, and this is the Sunday Sesh.